This episode is sponsored by Speakeasy. Grow your API user adoption and improve engineering velocity with friction-free integration experiences. With Speakeasy's platform, you can now automatically generate SDKs in 10 languages and Terraform providers in minutes. Visit speakeasy.com/codestory and generate your first SDK for free. This message is sponsored by QA Wolf. QA Wolf gets engineering teams to 80% automated end-to-end test coverage and helps them ship 5 times faster by reducing QA cycles from hours to minutes. With over 100 five-star reviews on G2 and customer testimonials from SalesLoft, Drata, and AutoTrader, you're in good hands. Join the Wolfpack at QAWolf.com.
I think every decision we made was, look, it's not going to be a long-term decision. It's literally just to get feedback as quickly as possible. So we tried to use templates of a UI, for example. And we did that just because we didn't want to spend time coding front-end components. And we just tried to strap everything together. We would do a lot of manual running of like these forecasting models in the background. We would do a lot of like manual testing with users' data. So we would tell them to send us an Excel sheet. And then we would do everything behind the scenes. And then tell them, like, go to this dashboard and you'll see everything. And the reason we did that is just because we knew that the hypothesis we were trying to test was not if we can sync data and build integrations between different like ERP systems or Excel, like Google Sheets or things like that. My name is Michael Louis, and I'm the co-founder and CEO of Cerebrium.
This is Code Story, a podcast bringing you interviews with tech visionaries.
Took 6 months moonlighting.
There's nothing on the back end.
Who share what it takes to change an industry.
I don't exactly know what
to do next.
Took
many goes to get right.
Who built the teams that have their back.
The company is its people.
The teams help each other achieve.
I was proud of our team.
Keeping scalability top of mind.
All that infrastructure was a
pain. Yes, we've been fighting it as we grow.
Total waste of time. The stories you don't read in the headlines.
It's not an easy thing to achieve, Mike.
Took it off the shelf and dusted it off and tried it again.
To ride the ups and downs of the startup life.
You need to really want it.
It's not just about technology.
All this and more on Code Story. I'm your host, Noah Labpart. And today, how Michael Louis is making it easy for businesses to go serverless and build AI applications in minutes. Michael Louis grew up in South Africa, spending the first 25 years of his life there. From young age and being surrounded by an entrepreneurial family, he was always curious. He got into robotics and coding early and stayed competitive and active as he grew up. Outside of tech, he loves to play squash, work out in CrossFit, run, and anything where he has an opponent. Also, per South Africa culture, he enjoys spending time with friends at any social event involving drinking. Michael built a successful e-commerce company where you could order different items from stores and have them delivered. Because the margins in e-commerce are low, he and his team wanted to figure out how they could optimize their operation using machine learning. The tools out there weren't ideal and the process was hard, but they did revolutionize their operation. Post-exit, he decided to build a solution that made his optimization process easier. This is the creation story of Cerebrium.
Cerebrium is a serverless infrastructure platform. So we make it easy for businesses to build, deploy, and scale AI applications. Basically, how we got started is, before this, I had a previous e-commerce company, basically the equivalent of an Instacart. You could order your groceries online from multiple different stores, and then they would all get delivered in one delivery within an hour. We grew incredibly fast. And the one thing about e-commerce businesses, it's very much a volumes game because typically margins are very low. And so we were thinking, you know, how can we optimize various parts of our business using machine learning? And it was honestly probably the worst experience I had in my entire software career. Tools were fragmented. No one really knew what was going on or how to productionize these things. It took long. What worked like in a development environment never really worked in production. However, the things that we actually ended up getting to production completely changed the way our business operated and worked. We were acquired by Walmart in 2021. And so when we got acquired, me and my co-founder, who was my lead engineer, we were like, this really sucked. This is probably the reason why it's not accessible to businesses that are smaller, seed, series A, series B, and only accessible to enterprise, just because of the amount of like investment it takes in terms of a resource and time perspective. what could we do, or what would we build if we could make building these applications easier? What would that do for small businesses globally? Definitely the original vision was a bit different. It was more like low-code tooling, just because AI is complex. And we got into Y Combinator with that. The vision ultimately changed that we're engineers. We like dealing with engineers. And so obviously it became a lower-level platform. And so typically the three things that we solve for that you'll notice when you're developing AI applications is, one, GPUs are extremely expensive. Obviously costs are decreasing all the time. However, more and more powerful ones keep getting released, that the cost just stays the same. So that's where serverless, which most people in the kind of engineering community would be familiar with, just makes a lot of sense, because you only pay for the kind of compute time that you actually use. What's so tough about that problem, and sort of it's been around for ages, is just that these models are so big. We're talking gigabytes of dependencies, model weights, and so loading them extremely quickly is a very tough engineering problem to solve, and that's what we solved. The second thing is that because there's a capacity shortage, all these cloud providers are trying to get companies to lock into year commitments, which you can ask any kind of Series B and below company, they hate doing and will not do because they don't have the cash to do that, because it's quite risky. And I guess the third thing is that now that you need to develop with GPUs, it doesn't come on your everyday laptop like a MacBook Pro. And so you can't just save a file and then quickly test it locally and then see what the result is and debug and build your application over time. So you constantly have to push basically like lines of code as you are changing your application to the cloud and then iterate on it. We basically build like a caching system where you can push your code and it's live within about 9 seconds. We're trying to replicate that local development experience as much as possible. And there's a ton of other things that we do in terms of abstractions to make it that typically come with machine learning applications, but I would say those are the three main points that we solve for.
Tell me about the MVP, or what you would consider the MVP, right? So that first version of the product you built, how long did it take to build and what sort of tools were you using to bring it to life?
I would say our MVP took us maybe just under 2 months. And the one thing for us was we just wanted to get at the hands of customers as quickly as possible. We started off actually just building kind of an inventory forecasting application for e-commerce companies, just because we had good contacts in the area and saying, look, we could forecast your inventory, which we built at one cart, so we also knew how to do it. Would this be valuable to you? Yeah, within the first 2 months, we had a demo, a couple clients working. That's actually what ended up getting us into Y Combinator. As we kept going, we realized that we were selling our solution to salespeople, logistics people, operational people, as we added more use cases, not just inventory forecasting. And me and the entire team were like, we hate our customer because we just don't resonate with them. So even though the company was growing, we were just like, we need to go with people we actually enjoy working with.
So let's stay on that for a minute. I hear you saying a few things that might apply to this, but I'm curious about decisions and trade-offs you had to make in that early version, right? You had to cut corners, right? Cut features, focus on one certain thing. You mentioned the customer. Tell me about some of those you had to work through and how you coped with the decisions.
I think every decision we made was, look, it's not going to be a long-term decision. It's literally just to get feedback as quickly as possible. So we tried to use templates of a UI, for example. And we did that just because we didn't want to spend time coding front-end components. And we just tried to strap everything together. We would do a lot of manual running of like these forecasting models in the background. We would do a lot of like manual testing with users' data. So we would tell them to send us an Excel sheet. And then we would do everything behind the scenes. And then tell them, like, go to this dashboard and see everything. And the reason we did that is just because we knew that the hypothesis we were trying to test was not if we can sync data and build integrations between different like ERP systems or Excel, like Google Sheets or things like that. It was, are they getting value from this tool? And so that's how we cut corners. There's lots of positives and negatives for doing that. Every entrepreneur has their, or even technical person has their own opinion on in what situation should you do what. I think no company is going to have a perfect journey in like the way that they make architectural decisions when designing. I think the main thing is just think about what's the hypothesis you're going to test and what are the minimum number of steps that you need to test that hypothesis.
This message is sponsored by SnapTrade. Link in user brokerage accounts and build world-class investing experiences with SnapTrade's unified brokerage API. With over $12 billion in connected assets and over 300,000 connected accounts, SnapTrade's API quality and developer experience are second to none. SnapTrade is SOC 2 certified and uses industry-leading security practices. Developers can use the company's official client SDKs to build investing experiences in minutes without the limitations of traditional aggregators. Get started for free today by visiting snaptrade.com/codestory. This episode is sponsored by Speakeasy. Whether you're growing the user adoption of your public API or streamlining internal development, SDKs can turn the chore of API integration into effortless implementation. Unburden your API users from guessing their way around your API while keeping your team focused on your product. Shorten the time to live integration and provide a delightful experience for your customers. With Speakeasy's platform, you can now automatically generate up-to-date, robust, idiomatic SDKs in 10 languages and Terraform providers in just a matter of minutes. SDKs are feature-rich with type safety, auto-retries, and pagination, everything you need to give your API the developer experience it deserves. Deliver a premium API experience without the premium price tag. Visit speakeasy.com/codestory to get started and generate your first SDK for free. Okay, so then let's go from that point. The MVP's working and you're gaining some traction. How did you mature and progress the product from there? And I'm curious about, you know, kind of to wrap that in a box a little bit, how do you build your roadmap? How do you go about deciding what the next most important thing to build or address is with Cerebrium?
I think obviously the number one thing is always listen to your customers and do user interviews and user research. But you're not always going to have customers that are willing to talk to you. And also, you do want to avoid the trap of using one or two data points as a final say on what you should implement. So I think if you can't get customer feedback initially, you obviously just have to go with an initial hypothesis and version of the product that you think is trying to solve the problem, and then get that into the hands of users and then iterate from there. We still do that, where internally as a team, we have to think, look, no one's really told us to build this, but we think that the way things are heading or the way these applications are maturing, we think we should build it. And we definitely do those decisions still internally today. But I would say number one is still the feedback from customers. In terms of how we decided to switch from the MVP to the second MVP version, we actually built just a wrapper around like platform, kind of doing something to some extent. We wanted to do something slightly differently. And so we just basically built a wrapper. But then obviously as I started onboarding customers, we started hitting limits with how we interact with their system. And so that's when we were like, there's enough traction here. Like, let's just keep going and actually start building this out ourselves. And so again, just trying to test hypothesis as quickly as possible, not doing it in a scalable way. And yeah, I guess that's how we decided to get started on, look, there's actually something here.
I hear you saying we. How did you go about building your team? And what do you look for in those people to indicate that they're the winning horses to join you?
Everyone that I've hired, I've worked with to some extent before, or they've come on an extremely high referral recommendation from someone else that whose opinion I value or trust. My co-founder, obviously, was my previous lead engineer, so I worked with him closely every day for 3 years, so I knew exactly what I was getting from him. And as a co-founder, he's been phenomenal, like very technical, can put his head down, get things done, can definitely zoom out in terms of an architecture point of view and think about what the product's evolving and really thinks about a lot of like architectural challenges and how to solve them. Our second hire was through a friend of mine who just said, this guy just graduated from Cornell with a master's in AI or machine learning, and he's originally a South African. I think the biggest thing in hiring an initial founding team is you honestly have no idea how the product is going to evolve and develop over time, that you have no idea how even someone's role is going to change. And so those early hires is you just want a bunch of smart people who have the right like kind of aptitude and attitude towards, can they easily switch and learn new skills, and are they passionate about the vision that you're trying to achieve? This is Eli. And so he was a phenomenal founding engineer for us. He was even in the initial part of the product, and then he had to switch to pure infrastructure platform. And obviously, he's got the determination to go to an Ivy League university as a South African. It's by no means an easy feat because you have to do a bunch of extra work and jump through a lot of hoops. So I think it just shows that if he puts his mind somewhere, he can do it. And obviously, that he's very clever. And then a few others, I would say, follow the same principle. So I would say in these early stages, we've only hired off referrals, recommendations, and people that we've worked with before. Just because that initial culture and the roles, I think they changed quite a lot. You just want people that you know and trust in their abilities to get things done.
This message is sponsored by SnapTrade. Link in user brokerage accounts and build world-class investing experiences with SnapTrade's unified brokerage API. With over $12 billion in connected assets and over 300,000 connected accounts, SnapTrade's API quality and developer experience are second to none. SnapTrade is SOC 2 certified and uses industry-leading security practices. Developers can use the company's official client SDKs to build investing experiences in minutes without the limitations of traditional aggregators. Get started for free today by visiting snaptrade.com/codestory. This message is sponsored by QA Wolf. If slow QA processes bottleneck your software engineering team and you're releasing slower because of it, you need a solution. You need QA Wolf. QA Wolf gets engineering teams to 80% automated end-to-end test coverage and helps them ship 5 times faster by reducing QA cycles from hours to minutes. With over 100 five-star reviews on G2 and customer testimonials from SalesLoft, Drata, AutoTrader, and many more, you're in good hands. Ready to ship faster with fewer bugs? Join the Wolfpack at QAWolf.com to see if they can help you squash the QA bottleneck. I'm curious about scalability. Given what you built, I'm sure this is a super interesting area. Did you build this to scale from day one with scale in mind? Or have there been interesting areas where you've had to fight it as you've grown?
Basically, what we did in the early days is we just threw resources at the problem and did not think about resource efficiency. We had a client come on that was running 250 concurrent GPUs. And we definitely did not have our platform ready to take on something like that, let alone Amazon has quota limits for GPUs. And so we kept hitting those all the time with just one client, so much so that I got in touch with the head of startups in Amazon on a Saturday. And I was like, tell someone to get online now and give me credits. I would say in the early days, we just threw resources at the problem, which I definitely don't recommend looking back. But I guess that's what we had to do at that stage in time. And obviously since then, we've like basically said, okay, how can we make this scalable? And I think the second thing is that's been pretty interesting is building an infrastructure platform, just because I've never done it to this extent, is you really have to think about your unit economics when it comes to infrastructure. There's so many moving parts. And yes, our platform can scale, but it's at least also pay for itself at the scale that you're working at. And so those have been like the two issues with scaling. It's just understanding how do you switch between spot instances, reserved instances, on-demand instances, different cloud providers. And yeah, I guess how do you make that all work together in a scalable way that then obviously your unit economics actually are good.
So as you step out on the balcony, you look across all that you've built thus far with Cerebrium. What are you most proud of?
One thing about our team is most of us are based in the US now, but originally all of us are from South Africa. We've been going against engineering teams who've graduated from these Ivy League schools like MIT, who've done all these competition programming things and won medals, been CTOs and founding engineers of these billion-dollar companies and all of that. Our team, pretty humble beginnings. People interested in solving a problem and can dive in and get our hands dirty. To date, we've built a platform that, I guess from our testing and from customer reviews, is one of the most performant on the market in terms of like speed, cold start times and things like that. We've done it with just local South African talent. We didn't hire contractors. We haven't had a US team member on our team yet. And so I would say that's the thing I'm most proud of. And I think the second thing, which, I mean, I started a few startups before this in South Africa. Some worked and some didn't. But South Africa's funding market is completely different to the US. Basically, how it works is you need to become break-even almost instantaneously. Otherwise, your company dies because there's not a lot of funding. There's a lot more now. And so to date, whenever I get onto a call with a US VC, and they see the size of our team and the amount of money we spend, they literally say it's completely fake. And they said there's absolutely no ways that this is what, like, the amount of time and effort and capital that it took to build a solution like this. So I'd say the fact that we were VCs in the space acknowledged that, and also our customers acknowledged that we're performant and we did it with a team that didn't go to Ivy League schools, didn't work with billion-dollar companies. I'd honestly say that's probably what I'm most proud of.
Okay, let's flip the script a little bit. Tell me about a mistake you made and how you and your team responded to it.
One thing being an infrastructure platform is engineers are very demanding. I should know since we all are one. And as soon as you solve one problem, they just want everything. It's like, cool, I've got the serverless GPUs. Now I want WebSockets. And then you get WebSockets. And then they're like, okay, well, I also want to do batching or like all these other things, streaming. And I think we just became this like feature engine in the early days, just trying to just satisfy as many requests from customers as possible in order to just onboard them. And I think we just didn't spend enough time on some of the fundamental core reasons why someone would use our platform. And an example of that is our cold start times. We got them pretty low, I think to about 12 seconds, roughly. then we started focusing on all these extra features. And I think as the market matured and people started putting these applications in production, they were like, just 12 seconds isn't good enough. And so I think we should have kept going as a company, really trying to just focus on that one core use case that we solve. Look, we might not offer WebSockets, we might not offer streaming, but cold starts, like we 100%, we have the lowest and it's the lowest we can get it. And we should have focused on that. And I think looking back as a team, that's what we look at the most. And I think we realized that 6 months later when, yes, we bought all these features, but those customers who asked for those very features ended up churning just because our cold starts weren't actually improving over time. So I'd say that was a pretty big lesson.
This is always super fun for me to hear. Tell me what the future looks like for Cerebrium and for your team.
I mean, for us right now, which I think has been pretty great, is I think the previous years, yes, there's been like a whole craze around machine learning and AI with GPT coming out and everything. And there's been a lot of investment and development in the space. They didn't have any experience or they didn't know how to actually apply this technology in their business or where to apply it. They didn't know what the ROI would be. It was too expensive. They might not have their data set up in the correct way. And so basically what we found is like the last year, while we've obviously been growing, a lot of companies have just been running these small scale POCs across the business. I think I even met with someone from the Bank of New York and they said they're running 600 individual use cases, but all in POC. What I'm most excited about is we already have a lot of case studies of like specific examples providing massive return on investment in terms of like cost savings, time savings, and things like that for companies. And so I think that's just obviously going to explode. And I think the business penetration of AI is still less than 1%. I think there's still so much to happen here in terms of the tooling use case. I think in terms of what the implementations that companies are going to build. I think some of the applications that are coming out now are pretty phenomenal. AI interviewers or AI training and all the voice agents that have been coming out now. It's pretty phenomenal. The future wave, one is you're seeing companies operate just much more efficiently. The number of companies that I'm hearing of now that are hitting millions in annual revenue and four-person team or five-person team is just exploding, I think is the first interesting point. I think two, seeing more and more companies who are seed to Series B, who are implementing AI from day one across their business in order to process customer interviews or write content or whatever the use case might be. And that's where our original vision stemmed from. We wanted this to become a reality. And look, whether it's our platform or one of our competitors that achieves it, the fact that at least the market is heading to a place that we wanted to see in the future is pretty exciting.
Let's switch to you, Michael. Who influences the way that you work? Name a person or many persons or something you look up to and why.
I feel like I have some serious answers and some not so serious answers. I look up to my dad a lot. I think the thing that he always told me from a young age was, and that he always ingrained into me, is always legacy. You know, what do you want to be remembered for and how people remember you? It's never been about like financial interest for me. It's always been about like the impact you can create, which I think is like a great lesson to teach, you know, future entrepreneurs. In terms of a not so serious, and my team always laughs me because I have a mild obsession is with Eminem. I think the reason why he's just not in the limelight, he doesn't feel like he needs to everyone to tell everyone that he's the best. I think he always says when he got the Hall of Fame speech, he just said his respect of his peers was all he wanted. And he's what, 55 now, 56, and he's still releasing albums and breaking records. And everyone still says he's the best to do it. I think just showing that you can come from any background and just if you work hard at it and you really have a talent for it and you put effort into it, that you can become the best in the world, I think is like pretty inspiring. That's been a constant motivation. Coming from South Africa, where there's a lot of unemployment and, you know, a lot of other issues as well. And then coming to compete against the best entrepreneurs in the world in the US, I would say that's also something that's pretty inspiring for me.
Last question, Michael. So you're getting on a plane and you're sitting next to a young entrepreneur who's built the next big thing. They're jazzed about it. They can't wait to show it off to the world and can't wait to show it off to you right there on the plane. What advice do you give that person, having gone down this road a bit several times?
Better be strong to get hit by real life because it's a tough journey. The thing that I've learned is success in a startup is always come and go. You're going to have some months or years or days that are going to be phenomenal and some that are going to be pretty bad. I think the biggest thing that I always say is more than what you're working on, it's more who you're working with. I think, you know, you spend such a great deal of time with your team, you're working like 80-hour weeks with these people. Besides being passionate about what you're building, make sure that you're building it with people that you, one, enjoy spending time with, two, that challenge you and don't just take your word for it, but really invest in the problem and constantly challenge you. I always tell my team, I love it when they like challenge me on a roadmap item or anyone else in the team, because it just shows that you care. I think if they just said yes the whole time, then they wouldn't really care about the direction of the product. And so I would just say, be extremely careful and I guess strict about who you hire and who you work with, because there's lots of also debates about what does happiness look like in the space and success. If you can work with people that every day that challenge you and you enjoy working with, for me, that's success.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree with that more. That's fantastic advice. Well, Michael, thank you for being on the show today, and thank you for telling the creation story of Cerebrium.
Yeah, pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And this concludes another chapter of Code Story.
Code Story is hosted and produced by Noah Labhart. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the podcasting app of your choice. And when you get a chance, leave us a review. Both things help us out tremendously. And thanks again for listening.